Good morning. Am I on? Great to see you all. It's really encouraging, isn't it, to meet together as Christians to think in a specifically Christian way about what it means to educate. And we're really, really fortunate to have with us this morning Professor Mark Pike of Leeds University. Hugh mentioned earlier his book, Mere Education, well, one of his books, Mere Education. I'd really commend it to you. It's quite countercultural, quite different from the prevailing trends and messages that we hear all the time in our schools and from our politicians. And let's hope they do arrive at 12 o'clock later on. Was it 12 o'clock, Hugh? So there we go, there'll be a queue at 12. Mark, could I invite you up? And I'm just going to ask Mark a few questions. Do you want to take to the lectern? I'll ask Mark a few questions just before he speaks to us. So good to have you with us. Where do you come from, Mark?
Thank you for inviting me. I grew up in Salisbury in Wiltshire and taught in the south of England for a number of years. Started teaching in Wales and then moved to Leeds in the year 2000, 16 years ago.
And what do you do at Leeds, in Leeds now?
So I'm Professor of Education and at the University of Leeds and head of the School of Education. So the School of Education is one of the units of the university. There's a law school, a medical school, a school of education, and we offer BA degrees in childhood and youth and education and teacher training. Have about 110 master's students, about 120, no, I think it's the other way around, I think it's about 110 PhD and about 110 master's students, so quite a few postgraduates, and very international. And they all arrived this week.
So. Busy man. And Mark, how does being a Christian shape what you do as an educationalist? I know the kind of short answer is read the book. But can you just give us a flavour for what that means now?
How does being a Christian influence being an educationist? In every single way, because education is so value-laden, schooling is so value-laden, whether you're looking at assessment practices, vocational education, streaming, setting, educational excellence, sex education. Did I mention assessment to start with? Schools are big on assessment. School discipline systems, behavior systems. All of schooling, every part of it is value laden. We don't live in a moral, theological vacuum. The underpinnings, the roots of how and why you discipline a child, how and why you teach a child, how and why you are the way you are as a teacher, could not be more, I've used the term, value laden, but what I really mean is it needs profound theological underpinnings. Your doctrine of man, your view of what education is and what it is for is of determining significance.
Thank you. And finally, everyone will have had one of these flyers on their seat about the Narnian Virtues Project. Could you just briefly say a word or two about that? And then I'll shut up and sit down.
So the University of Leeds is a research-intensive university, a Russell Group University, and as well as having all of those wonderful students, we do research and engage in research projects. And one of the research projects that I'm leading is the Narnian Virtues Character Education Project, where children read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in year 7, Prince Caspian in year 8, and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader in year 9, and seek to cultivate a range of virtues underpinning good character through their analysis and their response to those novels. And of course, rather wonderfully, the Narnia novels are a consistent moral universe. So certain behavior has certain consequences. And that consistent moral universe is very important for teaching children how to develop the virtues that are the building blocks of good character, that underpin good character. And we're grateful for funding. I have to say this every time. We are grateful, but I still have to say this, for funding from the Sir John Templeton Foundation, who are funding this over 4 years, and we want to take it to 25,000 children. And they've given us a £1.1 million grant to help us to develop the materials. And we pre- and post-test the children, not just for their knowledge, but for their dispositions, for their character.
Well, Mark, can I just pray for you before you speak to us? Let's pray. Father, thank you that all truth is your truth. Thank you that this is your world. And Father, we pray that you'd help Mark as he speaks to us now. Please give us hearts which are shaped by your word and by your truth. And we ask these things for your glory and for the eternal good of many. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. So, mere education. Firstly, I need to state that the views expressed in this lecture are my own, and also those of C.S. Lewis, of course, and not necessarily those of the University of Leeds. And I am giving this lecture in a private capacity, and the University of Leeds should not be held responsible or liable for any of the views expressed here. So, as a Christian and an educator, I find C.S. Lewis extraordinarily helpful in thinking about education and schooling, more so, perhaps, than any other 20th century writer. And in Mere Christianity, that I'm sure you've all read, C.S. Lewis observes that the application of Christian principles, say, to education, must come from Christian schoolmasters. And as I was a Christian schoolmaster for over a decade, and now teach teachers and lead education in a university, this talk represents an attempt by one Christian schoolmaster with much help from C.S. Lewis to do so. But the problem with C.S. Lewis over 50 years on is that most modern readers, including parents, teachers, and school leaders, may not find much of his thought specifically on education and schooling readily accessible. Not least because Lewis was a prolific author, and his thought on education is sprinkled liberally throughout 30 or more books in different genres. And there's no one big book by C.S. Lewis on education and schooling. There is one very small book, 64 pages, The Abolition of Man, published in 1943. But the thought of C.S. Lewis on education and schooling is so liberally distributed through his fiction, through his literary criticism, his theology, his ethics, that one of the aims of Mere Education, that's on the courier, apparently, on the way to us as we speak, one of the aims of Mere Education is to draw all of that material together for parents and for teachers and for those concerned with education, and to apply it to 21st century issues in education. So the idea of having the pictures of spiky-haired 21st century children, three of whom are my own, on the front cover was to say, you know, this isn't about... There are lots of books about C.S. Lewis and education, and they're about C.S. Lewis's education and, you know, the Oxford tutorial system, Malvern College, and it's really not about that You know, it's about how the thought of Lewis can be applied to children and teenagers today with, you know, their iPads and iPods and social media and Twitter accounts and, you know, all of that. And Jeremy, who's underneath C.S. Lewis's tie, Jeremy Pike, is in year seven. So he's been in secondary school for 3 weeks. And two down from him is Luke, who is here. He's a sixth former. And Lydia is two. I should have had one of those pens, but Lydia is two. Luke's wearing a medal or something after some sporting event, and Lydia is to the right of him, one up from the bottom row. And Lydia is in year 10. She's the... Well, let's just say I used to think I was strong-willed until I met my daughter. So, now then, the word Mia in the title of this book is used in its Middle English sense. Lewis was a world expert on Middle English. That's the English that was used before Caxton's printing press was introduced in the late 1470s, and after Anglo-Saxon or Old English, which was spoken in what is now England up until, you know, the 12th century. And as I say, Lewis was a world expert at Middle English. And the word mia as an adjective in Middle English means pure, unalloyed, unadulterated. Pure, unalloyed, unadulterated. For her birthday, I won't say which one, for her birthday last year, I took my wife, Babs, to the Kilns, Lewis's home outside Oxford. And we stood together in the room where he had written the Narnia novels that looks out towards the small mere, the small lake that was on the 8 acres that made up the Kilns. Although sadly, it is becoming silted up and quite muddy. He used to go bathing there, and you wouldn't want to do that now. We should be aware at the outset that we're often seeing schooling, we are seeing education from a silted up 21st century perspective. And I find Lewis helps me to clarify things. And that's what mere education is all about. It looks at assessment, vocational education, excellence in schooling, how to be an excellent school leader, pedagogy, how to be an excellent teacher. It looks at the aims and the underpinnings of education, sex education. So today I will draw upon, in the main, The Abolition of Man, which is Lewis's book on education and schooling, which was originally a series of lectures given to school teachers. And that will help us to challenge many widely accepted and popular ideas about education and schooling today. It is also prophetic. The Abolition of Man begins with character. Lewis begins The Abolition of Man by writing about character, and so shall I. The first part of The Abolition of Man is entitled Men Without Chests, because the heads, the intellect of the student, looks bigger than their chests, their character. Lewis shows that each of us is more than an intellect, a head, and more than an animal with appetite, a stomach. We have a moral sense and character, a chest. And when Lewis was saying that, we should remember that he was looking at a graduate of the schooling system. If it was a cartoon character, it would be the opposite of the bodybuilder, you know, with an expanded chest and a small head. It's a cartoon character. The schooling system Lewis observed produced And we should say that he taught 18-year-olds. So he took people on who were the product of the schooling system. He marked examination papers taken by school children, and he reviewed textbooks for secondary schools. And actually, the subtitle of The Abolition of Man is Reflections upon the Teaching of English in the Upper Forms of Schools. It goes far beyond that, but it is about the teaching of children 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, and he reviewed textbooks for schools. We'll come on to that in just a moment. For high school students, secondary school students. And the schooling system that Lewis saw produced young people whose chest, their character, was atrophied through lack of exercise. His assessment was not that schooling had educated the head, the intellect, too much, but that it had educated the chest, character, too little. And I want to suggest to you today that helping children and young people to develop good character in all sorts of schools is a tremendous opportunity for Christians in education. And there are many ways of providing character education, from the school discipline system to how people communicate with each other, from corridors to waiting for buses, from sport and other extracurricular activities and service learning to the curriculum itself. And I'll say something shortly about just one curriculum approach that I've developed with Professor Thomas Lacona at the State University of New York, this Narnian Virtues Character Education Project. But character education is a significant opportunity for Christians in education for a number of reasons. But one very important reason is this, as Thomas Lacona puts in his book, Educating for Character. He's really the father of character education in the US. And this is what he says. In its underlying philosophy, character education rejects moral relativism and reasserts the idea of moral objectivity. I'm so pleased that Jonathan Winch is able to be here today, and Gwyneth, the head teacher of Bede Academy. Jonathan is executive principal of a Christian ethos group of schools, the Emmanuel Schools Foundation, that believes in and is committed to character and nurturing good character in young people. I have the privilege of serving as the vice chair of the board of that group of schools and of working with Jonathan. And we're committed to raising aspirations and attainment in areas of deprivation in the north of England. And we're seeing many young people go off for the first time, the first in their family, to university. But there's much talk in education, much talk in schooling about children and young people fulfilling their potential. You know, everybody wants young people to fulfill their potential. But this is only possible if they have developed a range of virtues, a constellation of virtues that underpin and make up good character, that enables them to thrive and to flourish. So the Narnian Virtues Project is just one of many character education initiatives, and it seeks to inculcate in young people the virtues of wisdom, love, self-control, fortitude, justice, and integrity. Now, clearly, when those virtues are present in a young person, a whole range of options opens up for them in life that are otherwise closed to them. They can do things that they could not do otherwise. On the table on my right, your left, is what we call the character passport, the activities that they do at home with their parents. And the notion of the passport is fitting because, you know, if you're developing good character, it enables you to go places in life and to do things that you would not otherwise be able to do. and research in the Journal of Character Education. I'll read from Berkowitz and Beer's article, but this shows that high quality character education has many benefits, including fostering the good work habits that support academic attainment. Character education, say Berkowitz and Beer, has been demonstrated to be associated with academic motivation and aspirations, academic achievement, pro-social behavior, bonding to school, moral reasoning maturity, responsibility, respect, self-efficacy, self-control, self-esteem, trust in and respect for teachers. Now, I just mentioned that character education is a significant opportunity for Christians to serve in education. We are called to play our part in liberating children and young people from misery and oppression and hopelessness, taking the example of Jesus, who declared his mission at the start of his ministry in these words, in Luke 4. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. In the Authorized Version, C.S. Lewis's favorite. Now, of all the episodes in the Narnia novels, the release from slavery on Narrowhaven in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the third novel in the Narnian Virtues character education curriculum, made the greatest impression on our youngest son. Now, this might in part have been because he had been spending summer days visiting castles in Northumberland, dressed up in a helmet and armor, wielding a wooden sword and a shield made by his granddad, who I am honored to be able to welcome here today. Hello, Dad. Because it was my late mum and my dad who shaped my character in a Christian home. And the description of Caspian marching through the streets of Narrowhaven is certainly dramatic. The young King Caspian, in shining armor, strides into the slave market in front of slaves, slave dealers, slave buyers. He boldly pronounces, "I declare every slave in this market free." And for some reason, our small son, he was about six at the time, focused on what it would have been like from the perspective of a slave. He told us, "When you have been set free from being a slave, it feels like your whole life is starting over again." But freedom requires the right foundations to support it. I noted just now that in its underlying philosophy, character education rejects moral relativism and reasserts the idea of moral objectivity. But what happens when we have subjectivity instead? What happens to human liberty then? If students do not ask, "Is it true?" or "Is it right?" and instead ask, "Does it feel right for me?" then education will not be worth the name. Jean Bethke Elshtain recalls her daughter being taught in a New England college town that values were simply subjective opinions. She asked her daughter if slavery was wrong. And the response was, "I think slavery is wrong, but that is just my opinion. But that is just my opinion." And the danger of such teaching is that it undermines our humanity and militates against human dignity. It leads to the abolition of man, the termination of our humanity, the end of what makes us truly human and humane. C.S. Lewis begins his book on education and schooling, The Abolition of Man, by illustrating the problem with relativism with reference to one of the books for schools he had just reviewed. He calls it the Green Book, and he calls its authors Gaius and Titius to protect their anonymity. It was The Study of Language by King and Ketley, and it has a green cover. It is a scathing review. Lewis, and rightly so, Lewis shows that its authors do education and schooling more than a disservice. They are dangerous because they are indoctrinatory in the pejorative sense, because they teach unsuspecting students a falsehood, that values are relative. The values inculcated by the book are so potent because they are latent. And Lewis notes a whole series of approvals and disapprovals in the perhaps unconscious philosophy of its authors, who reflect the whole system of values which happened to be in vogue at the time of writing. The student has no notion that ethics, theology, and politics are all at stake. And it's an abuse of power because the student cannot know what is being done to him, Lewis says. I was in a school in Bradford recently watching a lesson on Romeo and Juliet. It was a year 9 class. And I want to put it to you that these approvals and disapprovals, these assumptions, are still routinely part of education today and the schooling experience of many children. And in the school in Bradford, the teacher was talking about betrothal and relationships and marriage. And she presented this very secular, comprehensively liberal perspective where, you know, she was saying, oh, well, back then, people got married, people got betrothed, and people got married before they had sexual relations, which is obviously completely different, you know, to what everybody does now, to the way we do things today. And I could see 2 Muslim children with headscarves, and I thought, well, their communities and families aren't going to agree with that perspective. And I couldn't see the 2 or 3, I supposed, evangelical children or Catholic children sitting there, because they weren't wearing headscarves, certainly if they were boys. But those children from those communities would not be agreeing with those pervasively secular, comprehensively liberal assumptions that the teacher was just taking for granted. So for Lewis, there is a right response and a wrong response. We were talking about relativism and relative values. For Lewis, there's a right response and a wrong response by human beings to aspects of the world around them. There's a right relation and a wrong relation between human beings and certain acts, events, and situations we come across in life. Lewis explains that certain responses in life really are better than others. What he defends can be summed up as the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are, the abolition of man. And there's a gulf between this Christian view and the secular, comprehensively liberal view. In schools today, as elsewhere in our society, people are apt to say that something is good because they think it is good, or because they value it, which is a complete reversal of Christian teaching that we are to value something because of its inherent goodness. Romans 12:9, Paul says, abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. And Lewis reminds us that this has happened quite recently. So he says again in The Abolition of Man, until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believed that objects did not merely receive but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or contempt. So C.S. Lewis shows that objective value underpins what it is to be a human being. And it's also vital if we're to develop the constellation of virtues that underpin good character. Acknowledging that morality stands outside of us and must be independent of our subjectivities is vital because, as Lewis said, the judge cannot be one of the parties judged. If one does not recognize objective truth, one has no basis or foundation upon which to cultivate any of the virtues. Moral relativism and subjectivism make it impossible to educate for good character. McDowell and Hostetler say that many of our youth do not understand or accept absolute truth. That is, that which is true for all people, for all times, for all places. Lewis calls this the Tao, the way. And the way is the title of the second part of The Abolition of Man. And the Tao is, which is spelled T-A-O, is pronounced D-A-O, as I found out from a very polite audience when I was giving this talk in Nanjing. The Tao is nature, it is the way, it is the road. Lewis uses terms such as righteousness, correctness, order, and truth to denote the Tao which is innate and universal. And of course, Paul wrote of a natural moral law written on the human heart that enables us to know right from wrong. Significantly, at the same time that Paul was writing that those who are not Jews show the work of the law written in their hearts, the Roman statesman Cicero was writing that there was a true law that is unchangeable and eternal. So now we come on to training in virtue, and you can probably see where this is going in an increasingly politically incorrect and necessary direction. So training in virtue, training is not a happy word in education and schooling. In the sense of inculcation, it may sound old-fashioned to some 21st century ears. But Lewis says this, hence the educational problem is wholly different as you stand within or without the Tao. For those within, the task is to train in the pupil those responses which are in themselves appropriate, whether anyone is making them or not, and in making of which the very nature of man consists. To refer to the title of this conference, Irrigating Deserts, Lewis wrote in The Abolition of Man, this series of lectures for teachers, that the task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. And I think it's important to be clear about what we mean by irrigating deserts. Bishop Michael opened our day conference today by talking to us about the deserts and about irrigating deserts. Universities are strange places. On the way to becoming a professor, you get to be a reader after being a senior lecturer, and it's a bit of a process to be a reader. You get 12 referees and six have to be outside of the country, and you know these people write and say that you kind of cut the mustard academically. And those are specialists that kind of know what you're talking about. And if all goes according to plan, you get invited for an interview in this great boardroom with a polished oak table, and there are 12 other academics drawn from different disciplines across the university who sit on one side of the table, and you sit all on your own on the other side of the table. And the first question, you know, is always, well, can you explain your research to us? And I had this, and you know, you plan what you're going to say as you're coming up to this event. And I was sitting in the little room about to have my interview about 5 years ago to be a reader at Leeds, and I'd obviously been reading C.S. Lewis the night before, because this probably wasn't such a clever idea. I decided to change what I was going to say about 5 minutes before walking into the room, and I was going to say, oh well, you know, I work on children's moral and character education, and I ended up sitting there, and they said, okay, so you know, what's your area of research? And I said, well, I'm interested in deserts. And I'm interested in how deserts are irrigated and why they're irrigated and the nature of the desert and how it has become a desert and, you know, what we should do about it. And, you know, it might have been okay, but the person asking the next question was a geomorphologist specialising in, you know, in deserts. And I had to sort of clarify what I meant. And I think it's important to clarify what we mean by irrigating desert, because it sounds very nice. You know, it sounds like the sort of thing that everybody can sign up to. Oh, education is about irrigating deserts. You know, who wouldn't want to do that? But we need to read the following sentence to appreciate Lewis's meaning. Ah, the word inculcation, training. Lovely. The right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. So to irrigate deserts is to inculcate, to train children and young people to have just sentiments or right responses. Now, Lewis acknowledges that no justification of virtue will enable a man to be virtuous. We need training because we will not at first have the right responses. Lewis says in The Abolition of Man that we must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. And the importance of trained emotions is of determining significance for the cultivation of virtue. The chest, according to Lewis, is the seat of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiments. When I was researching MIA education, I spent some time at the Wade Center, about 25 miles to the west of Chicago. It's a long story. It's at Wheaton College, and they've even got the wardrobe, the wardrobe that was in his bedroom in Belfast, that went from Belfast to Oxford, and now is 25 miles west. A very generous philanthropist who ran a national carpet cleaning company, rich American donor, has built this archive, the Wade, at Wheaton College. And I spent some time there and had a look at Lewis's own copy of The Abolition of Man. And I found some annotations in the margin. And you know, you lend books to people. So we photocopied it, we scanned it, and we sent it to Walter Hooper, who, you know, edits all the C.S. Lewis books. The late Chris Mitchell helped me, and we said, you know, Walter, is this Lewis's hand? Is this his handwriting? And it was yes, it is. And in his own copy of The Abolition of Man, he's added that a right code of conduct is, and this is the annotation, more easily obeyed if our passions are trained to add their weight. More easily obeyed if our passions are trained to add their weight. But we have to be clear, because at this point, Lewis and character education and Christian education for sure, and you and I could be accused of a crude behaviorism and of indoctrination as soon as we start to talk about training. So it's important to be clear. First of all, we need to dispel one myth about indoctrination very quickly. So very brief explanation. Not all indoctrination is of the Nazi, North Korean, or Chinese Cultural Revolution variety. Okay? Indoctrination literally is to lead children into a truth, a doctrine. In doctrine, in truth, to lead children into a truth. So you can lead children, or you can be led, to believe in fairness and justice, the importance of sharing, the importance of working hard, the importance of being honest. And you would say, it would be brilliant to be indoctrinated into being honest, to be led into the truth about being honest. Richard Pring, formerly head of the School of Education at Oxford University, says indoctrination arises as much from the secular assumptions of the media and the cold indifference to religion of the humanist. That there is pervasive secular indoctrination. And we should dispel another myth very quickly about behaviorism. So we certainly shouldn't interpret this emphasis on training or habituation in the abolition of man as endorsing a crude behaviorism. Many schools currently operate positive behavior strategies or assertive discipline techniques that are influenced by the behaviorism of B.F. Skinner, who was professor of psychology at Harvard. We're actually presenting on the Narnian virtues in about 6 weeks' time at Harvard. And Skinner placed rats in what has come to be known as a Skinner box, where food pellets were released if they pushed a lever. The right behavior was rewarded, and the rats came to associate an action with a particular result. You know, the Pavlov's dogs type of thing. They start salivating when the food walks in the room. So most positive or assertive behavior policies in schools tend to be based on Skinner's principle of operant conditioning, where students modify their behavior as a result of consequences, because they form this functional relation between the two through reinforcement. Now, don't get me wrong, a school needs to have clear rules and established sanctions if its rules are contravened. But that needs to be augmented by attention to the need for the student to develop good character. Unlike the rats in Skinner's experiments, young people, children and young people, are endowed by their creator with the capacity to discern far more than positive and negative associations. Do you see the difference? This is subtle but important. So if school leaders are to hold the young person responsible for their actions, they need to believe that the students are endowed with the free will to make good choices rather than poor ones. And that requires a far higher view of humanity than the behaviorist perspective. So the problem, not to say that social environment doesn't make a difference, but the problem with seeing children and young people as products of their environment is that their human capacity to choose well, to act with integrity, and to develop good character is militated against. The behaviorist is simply concerned with getting a child to behave well. A leader, a teacher, a parent that nurtures good character will help the child to develop the right motives for behaving well. This is what C.S. Lewis said. Right actions done for the wrong reason do not help to build the internal quality or character called a virtue, and it is this quality or character that really matters. So motives matter. That's in mere Christianity. So character education, and then a little story to end. So I said that I would mention something briefly about our Narnian virtues curriculum. It is not values clarification. It is not just reflection. We unashamedly want to change children. Shocking, I know. We want to change children for the better. The issue is not whether schools and teachers and parents influence children, but how they do so. We cannot not engage in character education. Character is modelled and developed for good or for ill. By commission or omission, adults influence children. So our intention is to work with children and young people and to work with them to develop a range of virtues. And our six are love, wisdom, justice, integrity, fortitude, and self-control. On the table over there, you may want to take a free magazine. It's an issue of Ethics and Excellence. Or it might be called Excellence and Ethics. It's called Excellence and Ethics. So you're very welcome to pick up one of those, but I've only brought about 50 with me. And that features the Narnian virtues. How do we develop those virtues in young people? Very simply, they identify the virtue or the vice that is being displayed by a character in one of the Narnia novels, and they look at the consequences of that action, and then they apply that to themselves. So, for instance, they'll look at Lucy's integrity. And at the start of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's open to the first extract over there, and it's entitled Lucy Was Very Miserable, because, as you know, she's been to Narnia, and nobody believes her. And the narrator tells us that she could have, you know, made all her problems go away if she had been prepared to say, oh no, I just made it up. It was all just a fantasy. But she has the courage of her convictions, a considerable fortitude, considerable perseverance, great integrity, and she refuses to cave in to this peer pressure, even though she is the youngest of the Pevensies. And so we ask young people to apply that to themselves and then to engage into what we call homework, but it's actually some activities with parents at home, because we recognize that parents are the first educators of their children. Another one is Edmund and the Turkish Delight. Self-control is the virtue. And we ask young people, what is your Turkish delight? You remember, he craves this enchanted Turkish delight. He sells out his siblings for this Turkish delight. And we say, what is your Turkish delight? And we did a pilot in six schools of some of these tasks, which was great fun, and it was brilliant working with these children. And a response that repeatedly emerged with regard to the virtue of self-control for these young people, we did it with, we were trying to figure out which age range was best, and we were working with 10 to 14-year-olds. And a year 8 class was particularly revealing. A response that emerged was with regard to mobile phones and the internet, particularly at night. And the students identified this lack of self-control exhibited by a character in the novel. They recognized it in their own lives as stemming from the perceived need to be socially available and doing all sorts of things online at all times and to conform to peer pressure. And one 12-year-old girl wrote in her journal, when I admitted, this is her words, not mine, when I admitted my internet addiction to my mum, she limited my time online. It was the right thing to do. Before, I was worried and forgot to eat. I was that addicted. And what the project seeks to do is to work with parents, to work so that the school works with the parents on the character of the child. And we develop good character through training. According to Lewis in Mere Christianity, What you mean by a good tennis player is the man whose eye and muscles and nerves have been so trained by making innumerable good shots that they can now be relied on. Now, it is possible that a bad tennis player could hit the ball in anger because he has lost his temper, and that the shot might, by chance, end up in causing him to win the game. But Lewis says it will not be helping him to become a reliable player. So how a child or young person is supported and enabled to develop the range of virtues that develop good character, that constitute good character, is of critical importance. And consistency is what matters. We can help children and young people strive towards that consistency, of course, but we can also guarantee that they, like us, will not act virtuously all the time, however good our schooling might be. Lewis observes, "No one knows how bad he is till he has tried very hard to be good." He suggests that if you try to practice, if you make some serious attempt to practice the Christian virtues over a 6-week period, then you will have discovered some truths about yourself. The main thing we learn, he says, from a serious attempt to practice the Christian virtues is that we fail. The point is not that God will, mere Christianity, it's where he says this, the point is not that God will refuse you admission to his eternal world if you have not got certain qualities of character. The point is that if people have not got at least the beginning of those qualities inside them, then no possible external conditions could make a heaven for them. That is, could make them happy with the deep, strong, unshakable kind of happiness that God intends for us. So, finally, well, we've been focusing on character education so far, a great opportunity for Christians in education. When teachers and parents teach honesty, justice, kindness, forgiveness, self-discipline, respect, civility, courtesy, responsibility, determination, they're fostering the sorts of virtues that form the basis of good character. So here we go. But people with different religious beliefs and different sexualities often agree on those virtues, but not about the specific application of those virtues in terms of sexual and religious behavior. C.S. Lewis acknowledges that in Mere Christianity. He says, it would seem, at first sight, very sensible to stop before we got there, disagreeing, and just carry on with those parts of morality that all sensible people agree about. Yet he asks, but can we? And we should ask ourselves the same question as we were talking earlier, Bishop Michael and I, particularly at this time in our culture. Lewis's inaugural professorial lecture at Cambridge University was entitled A Description of the Times. And he identified three phases in the history of the West: the pre-Christian, the Christian, and the post-Christian. And Lewis depicts the unchristening, the momentous cultural changes that have occurred, and some of their results. He is alarmed, or he was, even in the 1950s, he was alarmed at the prospect of being the spokesman of old Western culture. One can perhaps imagine him leaning forwards at a podium, something like this, and staring at his audience and telling them that the vast change which separates you from old Western is a chasm, even in the 1950s. And the implications of that chasm are immense because they concern what it is to be human. Now, Lewis distinguishes between the personally Christian, the personally spiritually Christian, which he describes as penitent and regenerate, and Christian civilization. But both matter. Christian civilization underpins the political liberalism that gives us a right understanding of tolerance and enables people to practice their faith unhindered, a really British value. The professor of politics and the cleaner of her office both get one vote because both are made in the image of God and have inherent worth and dignity. And the influence on liberalism, of Christianity on liberalism, is well documented. It's fed from two sources. First, we have the dignity of man, the possessor of freedom and reason. And secondly, we have the propensity for evil as inheritor of original sin. And the first makes democratic government possible, and the second prompts arrogance and conceit, therefore needing a source of restraint. I think there's a parallel in schooling where you can tell children that, you know, they can have high aspirations and achieve far more in all sorts of ways in life than they think, because they are made in the image of God. They have tremendous creativity, tremendous potential. But they also need boundaries and borders and restraint if that potential is to be achieved. But you know, a TA, a teaching assistant, told me just last week, and this is in the UK, in a politically liberal democracy, that her school, in its anti-radicalization British values training, after referring to the dangers of Islamic extremism and radicalization, one of the leadership team of the school told staff to beware of evangelical Christians too, who seek to undermine our values. In the Summa Theologica, St. Thomas Aquinas states that within natural law, there are first certain most general principles that are known to all, and secondly, certain secondary and more detailed precepts, which are, as it were, conclusions following closely from first principles. And states that the secondary principles of natural law can be blotted out from the human heart either by evil persuasions or by vicious customs and corrupt habits and even unnatural vices. There may well be a chasm between the values, the teaching of some secular state schools and those that many Christian parents and teachers would wish their children to learn. In the third and final section of The Abolition of Man, Lewis describes what he calls the controllers, the conditioners, an elite or establishment that exert control over the population and do away with traditional values and curtail freedom through schooling. Let's have a look. The controllers, the conditioners. And he foresees the rule of the conditioners over the conditioned human material, the world of post-humanity. In the 21st century, in the name of tolerance or social cohesion, the controllers, as Lewis called them, increasingly expect people to approve of and celebrate beliefs and practices that directly contradict their own faith. And they also expect school leaders and teachers to train children to do so. Nor are teachers in private Christian schools exempt, because the argument is now being made that if the state permits a school, even if it does not fund a school, if it permits a school, it should be made to conform to the state's image. We see a glimpse of this in Prince Caspian, the second of the three novels in the Narnian Virtues curriculum, the Pevensies are attacked by a great grey bear. Susan fails to shoot the bear with an arrow. She thinks it may be a talking animal rather than a dumb beast. When they've recovered, Lucy tells Susan that a horrible idea has come into her head. And she says, wouldn't it be dreadful if someday, in our own world, at home, men started going wild inside, like the animals here, and still looked like men, so that you'd never know which were which. Lewis foresees a time when we will witness the rejection of the concept of value altogether, where whatever Tao there will be. I'm on the wrong slide. I will go to this slide. So this is what the conditioners do, abolishing good and bad. That judgments of value are to be produced in the pupil as part of the conditioning. Whatever Tao there is will be the product, not the motive of education. The conditioners have been emancipated from all that. Good and bad applied to them are words without content. So in the name of tolerance, the controllers, as Lewis called them, seek to coerce parents, teachers, school leaders to approve of and even celebrate beliefs and practices which directly contradict their own. I said there was a little story to end. Let us try a thought experiment and imagine Lewis as a school teacher in a 21st century school. It's not that fanciful. Lewis may well have become a schoolmaster if he had not been appointed to his first temporary one-year job as tutor in philosophy at Magdalen College, Oxford. It was quite difficult to get an academic job. And let's consider how accommodating 21st century England might be, how our society might accommodate Lewis's traditional Christian views. Let's imagine Lewis as a teacher in a school, Jack, as he was known to his friends, working in a multicultural school in a city, sitting in a staff room around a coffee table after work with his friends, a Jewish teacher and a Muslim teacher. And on this afternoon, after a long week in the classroom, there's the usual quick wit and banter, good humour abounds. The friends disagree about central religious truth claims. Lewis's Muslim friend does not believe Christ to be God. Lewis does not believe Muhammad to be God's messenger. But they have most else in common. In terms of character, many virtues in common. They don't subscribe to the truth claims of each other's respective religious traditions, but they are friends nevertheless. And on this particular afternoon, the headline in the Times Educational Supplement reads, "Teachers must promote diversity." And it's been the subject of news bulletins throughout the week. The article notes that teachers must celebrate or approve of LGBT lifestyles as morally acceptable and morally equivalent to heterosexual monogamous marriage. Now, according to respected British ethicist Professor Brenda Almond, such teachers are placed in an invidious position, for this could have the effect of forcing them to choose between their profession and their conscience. The Muslim, Jewish, and Christian teachers, Lewis and his two friends, are by no means uncritical, but they believe that a duty incumbent upon them is to follow the teachings of their sacred text. The Jewish teacher quotes Leviticus, "Do not have sexual relations with a man as one does with a woman. That is detestable. And thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination." The Muslim teacher quotes from the Quran, "For ye practiced your lusts on men in preference to women. Ye are indeed a people transgressing beyond bounds. Would ye really approach men in your lusts rather than women? Nay, ye are a people grossly ignorant." These teachers are not homophobic, bigoted, or intolerant. But neither can they go against clear religious teaching on matters of sexual conduct. They do not feel they are at liberty to choose on this matter. Lewis considered the desire of a man for a woman to be normal, but the desire of a man for a man to be unnatural. And in this context, Lewis would have risked losing his job as a teacher of English if he was not prepared to teach that homosexual practice is an equally valid alternative lifestyle, or that sexual intercourse outside of marriage was acceptable. So too would his Muslim and Jewish friends. So we need to be wary of tolerance being so redefined that freedom of speech is curtailed for fear of causing offense. Professor Brenda Almond again reviews the ways in which the state increasingly expects people in a diverse plural society to celebrate and approve of lifestyles and practices that are contrary to their fundamental beliefs. She says, "Must we approve as well as permit? Must we refrain from judgment? Can we not condemn what we ourselves think is bad? Or is it wrong even to think in terms of good and bad?" And Lewis writes about the controllers, the elite, the establishment, the conditioners, who preside over the commodification of virtue itself, as their underlying philosophy will not permit them to describe these virtues as virtues, but only as desirable values or choices or preferences. Think back to Elfstein's child, who said, "Well, I think it's wrong, slavery, but that's just my opinion." And these politically correct values can change with public opinion, as human beings now believe that they are able to determine morality by majority vote. James Hunter's words in The Death of Character are especially apt. "Character cannot develop out of values nominated for promotion," he says, "consciously chosen by a committee, negotiated by a group of diverse professionals, or enacted into law by legislators. Such values have, by their very nature, lost the quality of sacredness, their commanding character, and thus their power to inspire and to shame." Not only do the controllers seek to undermine Christian ethics, they have also abandoned common ethics, claiming not to believe any one way of living to be better or worse than another. Brenda Almond again, "How can this have happened in countries like Britain and the USA, in which tolerance and liberty, especially freedom of religion and freedom of thought and of speech, are amongst the highest political ideals? How is it that the generalized principle of tolerance of diversity, non-discrimination, can result in criminalizing religious and moral objections to a practice?" As comprehensive liberals, the controllers will claim to defend autonomy, the autonomy of the child. They will encourage values clarification. They will be deeply suspicious of character education, and they will abhor Christian education, especially of the confessional variety. They will associate virtue theory and the promotion of virtue with right-wing politics, preferring social justice to the obligation to work on individual and personal virtues. As they recognize that virtue, or an awareness of the lack of it, may lead to faith, the controllers will set themselves implacably against it. After all, natural law may lead to divine law, and reason to revelation.